Hi there, I'm Michal and you're listening to the Rescue Tales podcast, the show dedicated to helping you settle your adopted rescue dog. In this episode, I chat with animal behaviourist Andrew Hale about the emotional experience of our rescue dogs and how we, as dog parents, can better support our furry friends to work through some of their emotional challenges. Andrew explains why it's so important that we understand the underlying causes of our dog's behaviour rather than just focusing on trying to fix the behaviours themselves. We also talk about how you can help get your rescue dog settled in the first few weeks of bringing it home, and Andrew talks us through some of the main do's and don'ts. Now, Andrew is a certified animal behaviorist with more than 10 years experience working in animal behavior. He follows a dog-centered care approach, working with empathy and compassion to try and understand why a dog is exhibiting the behaviors the dog owner might be concerned about. As always, I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you have a rescue tale that you'd like to share on the podcast, please do reach out to me on Facebook or Instagram on rescuetales.co. So hi, Andrew, and welcome to Rescue Tales. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Oh, it's great, and thank you for having me. It's brilliant to be here.
So before we jump into all the wonderful things we're going to talk about today, tell us a little bit about your background, what you do, and particularly your experience as a human psychologist.
Okay, so I'm a certified animal behaviorist here in the UK now, working predominantly with dogs. I've got a human psychology background, so I was involved with human therapy before I came to animals. And that's important for me because we're probably going to unpack some of this now, but the thing I've always been fascinated in is the emotional experience, what that is, what it means. I say we can unpack some of that in a bit. And I've just brought that over from my kind of human, working with human days to well, I still work with humans now, but with working with dogs and just asking more of a philosophical question about stuff, really, when we think about behavior and that side of thing. So that's really important to me. But the emotional experience isn't just about the dog, it's also about the owner, right, the carer. It's also about us as practitioners. And I do a lot of work with the rescue community. And what I find is that a lot of my colleagues in rescue already get this stuff because they see these animals at their most vulnerable. They see that just doing a bit of extra training probably isn't going to be enough for them in that scenario, that actually it's more care orientated than it is task orientated. I think that's important. But also they recognize a lot of the things I talk about in themselves because, we all have these part of our own emotional experiences is how we process the stuff around us, how we deal with the stress that we find, how we carry the burden that comes with us, especially working in rescue. I've got just so much respect for my rescue colleagues. I dip my toe in and out. I'm not there all the time. I'm just one of those behaviorists who turns up a couple of times and says, let's try this. But to be there all the time, it's just an amazing set of people, really. And sadly, I think that empathy, that passion, that compassion is often overutilized because, rather than thinking about their emotional needs themselves as professionals, it's just taken for granted that they'll turn up again because they love the animals. And I think we need to think about more in the area of pastoral care. So I run Dog Centre Care, which is a Facebook group, and also it will be an online educational and support platform, building that up soon. I'm also the behaviourist for Pet Remedy, which is a great product for helping support animals with de-stressing and their kind of emotional needs. And also I'm the behaviourist for the British Isles Grooming Association, which is a new thing for me. And I think it's great that the grooming community are looking to educate more about emotionality and emotional need.
What you said about people working in rescues, I completely agree with you, and the need to give them the pastoral care that they need as well. I was reflecting on this the other day and thinking, I try to be really attuned to my dog's emotions. And sometimes I find that quite painful. And I'm like one person with one dog, right? who doesn't thankfully have any severe emotional problems. And I was just thinking, oh my God, I can't imagine what it would be like to be working with these animals all day, every day. It must be emotionally exhausting. If you have so much compassion, it must be draining.
So yes, completely agree that they absolutely need more support, because that can just be very, very difficult, as much as it is rewarding.
I think there is often a narrative, especially in kind of center-based rescue, where you might have a charity or, you know, management structures and that kind of thing, where a lot of the care staff are told, look, don't get attached, don't get involved. the problem there is, when they hear that, is they are going to get attached, they are going to get involved. But now that they've been told that by line management or whatever, now they feel they can't share they're feeling. And I think that's a culture that we have to break down a little bit more. And I think we were talking about this off air before we came on. If we have a very task orientated view, so it's like, I need this dog to do this, I need to get this dog groomed, I need this dog to do that, there is a certain protection there, because the aim, the focus, is the task. Need to get attached to them. When you start to have more of a care focus, when you become available, we'll talk about this a little bit more in a moment, when you become available to the emotional experience of another, when you become available to the truth of another, it takes a lot from you. You can't not. And we have to be better equipped with our own kind of personal care and our personal toolkits to be able to kind of mediate through that, navigate through that.
Yeah, and that's a really good segue into my next question, because you touched on the emotional experience. And, you know, let's for now talk about dogs. What do you mean by their emotional experience? What emotions do our dogs feel? And maybe what emotions do they not feel? And what is an emotional experience for a dog?
It's a really good question. And I think this is the beautiful thing. And this is why my little thing that I'm trying to bring is to get people to think about the concept of the emotional experience. So what is it then? Let's just think about it, even from our point of view first, and we'll attach it to the dog. You and I will share a lot neurologically and physiologically. And actually, that's where science is really helpful. We're learning more and more about brain processing, the role of the nervous system, how things are connected, the gut-brain axis, all these kind of wonderful things, which we also know, many of which apply to our dogs. Okay. The emotional experience, however, is a unique one. So you and I will share a lot neurologically, physiologically, as will our dog. But how we individually add value to what we experience, how we feel, how we process the sensations that we encounter, how our brain decides to add value to certain things, will create a very unique emotional experience for us. Now, the thing that's been said a lot in the past, not just with dogs, but with animals in general, is, well, we don't know what they feel. We don't know what emotions they experience or whatever they do. So therefore, we won't think about it. We'll just focus on what we do know, which is observable behavior. I think that is a bit of a defunct argument now. This is my opinion, because just because I don't know and wouldn't dare to presume your emotional experience, it doesn't mean that I can't be available to learning more from you and finding out more about it. So what I know is there are three component parts that we kind of know about regarding the emotional experience for me. First is sensory input. So that's sensory integration. So same for our dog. So the dog's brain has to take on information somehow, and it does that through its senses, external senses and internal senses, of course, you know, pain receptors and all that kind of stuff. So the brain is taking all that information. And the second part of that is processing. The brain needs to process that. You know, it needs to add value to stuff. It has to work out, what do I feel about this stuff? And then the third part is the nervous system. So the thing with the brain, once the brain's done its processing, I have a little analogy that I use, which is the doors of the brain. So if you imagine the dog's brain has lots of little doors in it, same applies to us. We need as many of those doors to be open for that dog to be able to safely and calmly and rationally, properly process what's going on. Right? Pain and stress are big door closers. They are for us. So we have expressions, don't we, like, oh, I can't even think straight, or I can't deal with this right now. Because if we haven't got enough doors open, if we're not able to have a free flow of normal processing, we just can't deal with it. We can get very overwhelmed with information very quickly. And then the final bit is the nervous system. I use the good old bucket analogy, which is quite a well-known one within clinical circles and psychology circles. So if you imagine the empty bucket denotes the nervous system, which is the stress system, and the water in the bucket is about how much that stress system is activated, how much that nervous system is activated. The fuller the bucket, the less doors we've got open, the less chance of a rational, mindful, self-regulated response, the more chance of an irrational, potentially, and this is the important word for me, reflexive response. So we all know that we can all say and do things in the moment when our bucket's a bit full, right? And that because it's reflexive, same for adults. So this is, we kind of know about this stuff. So, you know, I don't like the word aggressive, for example. I don't like that word only because it doesn't tell me anything. What does it tell me? It tells me the dog's stressed, tells me the dog is seeking relief potentially. And for me, that's an important word in the psychology of behavior. And especially when we think about the emotional experience, as soon as our nervous system elevates, we want relief. We want to feel, not feel that anymore. We want to feel something else. So this is part of the emotional experience. So when we think about dog, then we don't need to necessarily know, do they feel happy? Do they feel this? Do they feel that? We can just think, right, are you able to process what's going on? Is that nervous system at rest? Is that nervous system elevated? Remember, that nervous system can elevate through excitement. It doesn't have to be anxiety. The big thing for me is, you know, we take it for granted. That's, I like to use the word abstract before the word normal, because what's normal, right? As abstract normal human beings, over 95% of what we process, we do so subconsciously, because it would be exhausting otherwise if we had to kind of cognitively appraise everything. But anybody who's struggled with anxiety in their life or has gone through an anxious period or a very stressed period will know that percentage drops quite a lot. And you're a lot more aware of what's going around you, and it's harder to process, and it can be easier to be overwhelmed. And what we know neurologically, my good friend Kathy Murphy, who's on the Beyond the Operant chats with myself and Kim Brophy. People don't know Kathy, she's a neuroscientist. We always need one in the room, I think, because it's, you sort of have a hear that. There is nothing that tells us that dogs don't struggle in the same way when they're overwhelmed, struggling to process. You know, we see it, I prefer the word sensitive to reactive, because the dog is sensitive to something that they are struggling to process before that nervous system takes over. They're less likely to self-regulate. So this is just that's the kind of I hope that kind of made sense. The emotional experience, I think that's the point, that the two things about the emotional experience, one, we all have one. You have one, I have one, the dog has one, the cat has one, the horse has one, right? They have to. Because the brain itself, when the brain's decided something, it can't do anything. I see the brain a little bit like somebody sat in a CCTV room with all these screens and monitors, right? It's taking all this information. And if they see a problem in sector two, they can't do much because he's in the CCTV room, right? So he has to pick up the phone and make a call. And that's our nervous system. Our nervous system is that call to action. We have to feel hungry, feel thirsty, feel scared, feel happy, feel something to get us to do something. So we all have an emotional experience. The second part of it is they're all unique to us individuals. Mm. And that's where I see it as being our own truth. It's our truth that, and then we come up with this concept of being available to the truth of another.
Mm.
And the problem with the more traditional view of dogs with a very heavy kind of bias towards controlling and changing behavior, whether we do that nicely or punitively, is that that's very much about our narrative now. It's I've decided that behavior is bad, naughty, wrong, inappropriate. I've decided that. And I need the dog to either stop that, which is a more of an aversive response, or get the dog to do something else, which is a more of a kind of reinforcing response. But we risk not being available to that dog's truth during that process, because we can change behavior, we know the how very well, we need to start asking more about the why and becoming more available to the truth of another.
I think, that's incredibly insightful. And I love what you said about, you know, how similar we are physiologically and neurologically, but emotionally, we all have, you know, we experience emotions in our own unique way. And it just makes me think that the majority of the dog training industry seems to me to be based on a cookie cutter approach, whether it's, you know, using aversive methods or positive reinforcement, but it's kind of like a standard approach. And in my head, I'm like, well, if each dog's emotional experience is different, also depending on the environment and the context, then how could we approach trying to change a behavior in the same way? In my mind, there's this conflict that I see in terms of like what's being accepted. Also, because I think as dog owners, we have a responsibility to be more aware of these aspects of our dog's life experiences and support them accordingly. But I suppose my second question is, how do you do that in practice? Like what? So I can give you an example. So I know someone who she adopted a rescue dog 7 years ago, and at home, her dog is, you know, wonderful. She's happy. She's just a happy dog. She takes her out, and if she sees a child, she sees another dog, she will start barking, she will start lunging. She, you know, the intent to bite is there. She's obviously quite scared, and she's gone to multiple trainers, multiple behaviorists, and nothing seems to be working. You know, they might make a tiny bit of progress, but over the course of 7 years, they've not really made much progress. She still has to keep her on a really short leash, can't ever be off lead, super careful around kids. And I hear, and I feel, you know, I really feel for her, because I'm like, from her perspective as a dog, she's tried so many things and nothing is working. And she said to me, so I just accept that maybe this is just how she'll always be. How does someone like that go about supporting their dog?
Quite a bit to unpack there. So the first thing I would say, obviously I don't know the case specifically, but I can talk generically about things, but nothing has worked. Well, something has worked, which is her acceptance of her dog.
Mm.
And we shouldn't see that as some kind of negative thing. I think for me, acceptance and awareness is the two most important ingredients we have to start with.
Mm.
Because this is the big debate. This is the whole thing about behavior change. I wrote a piece recently called Whose Behavior Is It Anyway?
Mm.
Because behavior, as far as I'm concerned, I invite people listening now to think about today or yesterday. Depends on when somebody's listening, of course, if it's very late tonight or early in the morning, who knows. But anyway, the point is, think about yesterday, today, how often you consciously thought about your behavior, you consciously controlled your behavior.
Mm.
The answer is probably not much, because we just do. We do stuff based on how we feel. We do stuff in the moment. That's why sometimes we can say and do things, especially to loved ones, that we might regret later when we've kind of elevated a bit. We don't think about it in the moment. So our behavior is very much an expression of self. Our behavior is as unique to us in many ways as the way we have our hair done, the way the clothes we wear. You know, it is us, is what we are, and because it's an expression of self. I would also invite people to think about the times when they have had to control their behavior, they've had external pressure on, which of course something we can all think about because of lockdowns now and that kind of thing, where we've had a lot of arbitrary external pressure on us to act in some way. Definitely when we think back to school, most of us went through a structured educational system where there was expectations put on behavior, which some of them might be quite reasonable, but many of them actually for some people were very difficult, especially if you had a way that you needed to express yourself that didn't fit that conformality norm. That's why a lot of people have failed by a structured educational system in the workplace, in relationships, sadly. So, excuse me, this is the thing about behavior. So we have ended up with a very heavy bias with dogs about externally, arbitrarily, just looking at the behavior and changing it without thinking about the emotional experience or the emotional drive that triggered it. And this is why for some dogs, you know, there's this kind of notion there that, you know, if it's not working, train more, train more, train more. In my experience, many of these dogs, the last thing they need is more training. They need more listening to. Just arbitrarily trying to get the dog to, so the dog's barking and lunging, to then get the dog, right, I'm either going to punish you for that, which of course is really bad because the dog's already stressed. But even if we think, right, I'm going to get you to do something else instead, I'm going to get you to get do something that I find more appropriate. That's great, but not if that dog's emotional experience, that dog's emotional drive still hasn't shifted. And that's quite often dogs will seem to improve for a bit because they attach to the new novel bit of training or the really strong reinforcer, whatever it is. But there's a great expression, there's a great saying, which is emotions will always find a way out. So if we can easily suppress emotions just as much through positive training as we can through aversives, and it's just a thing that we have to have, it's a reality check there. You know, we can be just as coercive and controlling through positive reinforcement as we can through aversion. So I think this is the point. So for me then, how do I navigate this? There's the kind of mainstream view of training, when we think about it in a normal training thing, is how to do it faster, how to train faster, how to get the behavior to last longer and all that kind of stuff. I do completely the opposite. When I say it's not just me, many people who do this, of course. I slow stuff right down, right down. So if we've got a dog then who in certain contexts or when they're exposed to certain situations, that nervous system takes over. The last thing I want to do is put the dog in that situation when I first meet them. I want to learn from that dog as much as I can when that nervous system is backing off a little bit. So when I first meet the dog, then say the dog is sensitive around other dogs. Traditionally, you'd bring in a stooge dog straight away and you start working. That's not how I do it. So I would just, I'd want to see how does that dog process me? How does it process the environment? How does it orientate in the environment? Orientation is really important for mammals, including us, to feel safe. It's the somatic system shifting and moving and thinking, I'm just going to shuffle over here. If you do a bit of human watching, just sitting in a cafe and watching people, it's amazing how people shuffle around. They don't even know they're doing it just to feel safe, right? So I need to learn all that first, and I've got to get a really good idea about how that dog processes and what that dog needs. Then when I'm going to start thinking about any kind of exposure to the thing the dog might struggle with, I need to give that dog lots of really good experience about processing differently anyway. So Laura Donaldson, amazing lady, Laura Donaldson, she's well worth having a chat with. She educates a lot about slow thinking, about cognitive reappraisal, because the brain, same for the dog, same for us, doesn't like to reappraise much. So my approach is very much about trying to help the dog to have the ability to self-regulate when it sees the child, the dog, and the person, not to me to throw in and micromanage and do loads of cues. And I think that's where a lot of the dogs who come to me are people who have gone down that more traditional route of doing lots of cue training, and it hasn't worked because the dog's emotional load hasn't been altered. Because the problem isn't the behavior, it's how the dog is feeling. And then even more traditionally, we think about counter conditioning, don't we? Even that, we have to put a question mark there. And how about, what are we counter conditioning? What are we creating instead? Does it actually have internal value to the dog? Do we think, oh, just by pairing food with the thing now, the dog's going to feel differently? Sometimes they might. In my experience, often they don't. They now feel differently about doing something else, but they still haven't necessarily had a chance to think, right, nervous system, back off. Brain, open some doors. Let's have a look at this. What do I feel about it? What works next? How can I deal with it? Because that's ultimately where we want to get the dog to be, right? So slowing stuff down is really important. And when we think about dog-dog things, for example, or even dog-human sensitivities, I find a lot of dogs, not all, of course, but many, they don't actually have a problem with the trigger per se. They have a very specific criteria that they need to go through regarding social processing before they can even think about or deal with social engagement. But they've had a history of social engagement thrust on them. Dogs running into their space, people trying to touch them, not being able to move and orientate in the ways they need to. And if you're a more sensitive dog on the more sensitive end of the spectrum, you don't have enough capacity to deal with that extra stress. So then the nervous system starts thinking, so that I'm just going to kick in first. I'm going to kind of bark first and we'll ask questions later sort of thing. And when we start looking at it in that way, we start to have a different view now.
Mm.
The traditional thing that we see a lot, and it's there all over the place, is that, oh yeah, the dog must be fearful of that other dog. The dog is trying to do distance increasing behaviors. The dog is this, the dog is that. We're making a huge amount of assumptions there.
Mm.
When you slow things down and do really good observations, the amazing Sarah Fisher, have you interviewed Sarah?
No. Sounds good. Like I should.
Oh my God, Sarah. So especially for the rescue community, she does so much and she's a big influence for me, Sarah. When you think about free work, which is people should look that up. Sarah's Facebook group is ACE Connections. ACE is Animal Centered Education. Sarah's amazing. We have to have really good observations. Now, observing without judgment or label is actually quite hard. And this comes back to the thing we were talking about a minute ago about being available to the truth of another.
Mm.
Now, this is something else I talk about and educate about, and we need more education on this, which is the psychology of judgments and expectations.
Mm.
Because we all have a worldview, a belief, it's a belief system. That's because the brain, like we talked about, doesn't want to have to keep reappraising all the time. So it's like, what do I think about coffee? What do I think about Emmerdale? What do I think about RuPaul's Drag Race? You know, whatever it is, we don't have to keep rethinking it. We just think, right, this is my worldview. This is my belief system, which is underpinned by our value system. When we have that belief system, then the brain wants to protect that. It doesn't have to keep rethinking it. So it comes up with cognitive biases, cognitive distortions, all these kind of things are there. From that, we have judgment based on that belief system and then expectations. If those expectations are not met, there is a real drive to want to control, change and coerce. So that's why the whole dominance model feels so connected for many people, because they're like, oh, yeah, well, my dog's dominant. If the person believes my dog is dominant, if the person believes my dog is bad, my dog is naughty, my dog is whatever, then that will kick in then about their real desire to change that.
Mm.
It doesn't matter how it happens, we need to change it. So to truly be available to the truth of another, to be available through good observations of a dog, we have to be mindful of our own biases, our own things, you know, and I'm the most judgy person on the planet, right? I really am. So I have to be, that's just that side of me, right? So I have to put that, I have to be really mindful to check that side of me in a minute and think, oh, okay, what, let's just be in the moment with this dog and see what this dog, and slow stuff right down. Because the big stuff, barking, lunging, whatever, doesn't really tell us anything. It tells us the dog's stressed, right? But it's the little things that we build up on. So if I was working with the dog you were talking about earlier, I'd want to strip everything right back. We've got to make sure, for me, dogs who experience high elevation around triggers, in my experience, there is always one of three reasons. There is a cognitive issue for this dog. So there is some form of, you know, issues regarding cognitive processing, which could be many things. You might think of younger dogs, for example, so adolescent dogs, for example. They have the brain capacity to have fully formed for the emotional responses and emotional responses and all that comes with that. The parts of the brain that help to modulate that don't come online until they're older. So literally some of those doors aren't even open yet. So there is a cognitive issue there. Also, when you think about dogs with cognitive decline, when you think about some dogs who through breeding, actually, we bred them to have a very quick sensory input nervous system response. When we think about border collies and that kind of thing, you know, so it can be very difficult for them to process people. So it's cognitive. The second is trauma. Some of these dogs have genuine trauma that in my dog-centered care group, I had a great chat with Rachel Leather, who's a trauma specialist, worked with both humans with trauma and now animals. It's one thing that gets missed a lot. Trauma-informed care is a big part of it for many of these dogs. And if this is the point, we can try and shift their behavior as much as we like. We can try and arbitrarily change the behavior because we can. But if we haven't addressed the elements of trauma in that dog, we're going to have another issue somewhere down the line. Or a dog who just ends up having that kind of learned helplessness, that kind of, you know, they stop externalizing. So, yeah, cognitive trauma or physiological. And I would say a huge percentage, like over three quarters of the dogs who I find have very big elevation events around the triggers, especially dog-dog ones, have a physiological element and usually something in their lumbar sacral area. Which now we're starting to think, instead of using words like aggressive, now we're thinking, wow, you're just being defensive.
Right? Pain, maybe.
Pain and discomfort and soreness and, you know, nervous system sensitivities, a lot of stuff there. So again, coming back to the dog that you're talking about, I just want to make sure that we are looking at the dog holistically, that we are just stopping everything and giving the person permission to not take the dog for a walk. Mm. And after all, finding quiet places, it's not a cop-out, it's a sign of a great carer. Mm. You know, if you've got a family member who is socially sensitive, socially phobic, maybe, you don't force them to go downtown on a Saturday afternoon because they can't cope with it. You avoid town on a Saturday afternoon. It's okay. And when you start thinking, when I see a client then, for example, how I introduce this is the first thing I do is ask the client, how do you feel about stuff? Just tell me how you feel. So I'm not even asking them about all the kind of yeah, they've already filled in their history form, so I've got kind of the kind of datary stuff. So I'm just saying, how do you feel then? What does that make you feel like when Rover's doing that? And they'll be like, well, I feel angry, I feel disappointed, I feel guilty, I feel shame, I feel, because they get, and because we're already talking about feelings now, right?
So yeah.
And they've also had chance to share that right away, which is important for them because they're like, wow, that's good, I need to get that off my chest, right? And we might have a bit of a cry, we might have a little bit of a, and that's fine. So that's important. The second thing I do then is introduce the emotional experience in a very neutral way. So I talk about the doors of the brain, I talk about the bucket, I talk about the process of elevation, decompression, the need for relief, I talk about that. Then I put that back to them and I say, right, so in that situation, then your bucket is pretty full, right? And they're like, yeah, I get that. But now, so that's an hour. And I haven't even talked about the dog yet. Now I feel they're in the right place for us to look at Rover. Because I hope now that belief system they might have had, that Rover's a bit of a dickhead or, you know, sorry, sorry, or dominant or naughty or bad. Now I'm hoping their brain has looking at things a bit differently, and we think, wow, oh my God, Rover's bucket must be a bit full, actually. Rover's, you know, has not many doors open and that kind of stuff. And if we think about if they've done things, they've used aversives in the past or they've done different bits and pieces, we can look at that now without judgment because they get it now. They're like, wow, actually, I can see now. I was just doing that. A guy said to me once, and he used to have, you know, the end of the lead where the loop is, the handle. He used to whack his dog on the bum with that. So and he shared that with me and that kind of thing, and so I said okay, blah, blah. And he said to me, do you know what, Andy, I didn't do that to punish him, I did that because I was angry. And I thought, wow, that is so open and so candid of you. And I think sometimes we think, oh yeah, you're punishing your dog. Are they deliberately punishing their dog, or are they really, their own bucket is overflowing and they are extremely, that, yeah, that kind of emotional experience for them has gone into red zone for them. So I'd never advocate eating a dog, of course, but now he saw in the moment, yeah, that was about my anger. And there are some people who are abusive. They just are. There are some people who don't have any empathy or compassion. We can say the same towards children, partners, family, you know, that's the same. But the vast majority of people love their dog, love their kid, love their partner. They just find that the emotional experience is a difficult one for them. So this is why I think then about when we start thinking about these things, because as a trainer, if we turn up with an operant model and say, right, okay, yeah, Rover, I get that. Yeah, we don't want Rover doing that anymore. We're going to do this instead. We don't do hitting and that kind of thing anymore. You know, we don't use dominance now. It's all done in a nice way. We use positive reinforcement, blah, blah, blah. There's a good chance when we're saying all that, because of that belief system thing I was talking about, that the carer, the owner, is still hearing behavior bad, must change it. So if the expectation for that isn't met by us as a positive trainer, and they go down the road to the shock jock and they still get behavior bad, must change it, we haven't altered that belief system for them. I genuinely believe we've got to start, I call it the operant merry-go-round. We've got to stop fighting this battle on methodology and tools alone.
Yeah.
we're just going to go round and round all the time. Mm. We need to step off that and say, well, actually, if we think about the dog's emotional experience, start thinking philosophically about what that is, looking at the science that is there to support us regarding neurology, physiology, looking at the wonderful work of people like Kim Broffey, another person, let's say, worth having a chat with. Her book is called Meet Your Dog, which is, she's an applied ethologist. When we start thinking in those terms, we don't need to have a debate about methods and tools now. I don't need to kind of spend an hour debunking dominance now to my clients because they get it. They're like, right, actually, that whole dominance thing is about external control over the behavior of another without thinking about what that behavior is intrinsically meaning to them. So it's just a different way of looking at stuff, right?
It's no, I think it's great because, you know, just listening to you talking, I'm thinking about my own kind of judgments and biases. And it's just a complete shift in how we think about and perceive and respond to our relationship with our animals. And to think about, first and foremost, ourselves and our emotional states and how that's driving our behavior and our expectations of our animals. And that's really hard to do, right?
It is, but this is also about our relationship with ourselves. Mm. You know, people say to me, well, it must have been easier with humans when you're doing human therapy because they, you know, come and see you and they talk to you and that. And it wasn't, because we are really rubbish at recognizing the emotional experience, and we are really rubbish at communicating emotional need. So, you know, I could spend an hour with somebody listening to them, and I have to pick the bits out and try and mirror that back and say, so do you mean this then? And is this what you think? And that kind of thing, to try and pick it, because it's difficult. And that's because as humans, you know, we're a very flawed, really, and very complicated species, because we are an animal. So we share a lot with our dogs and other mammals regarding that nervous system and that kind of thing. But we also have a big thinking brain, a brain that likes to ruminate, a big philosophical brain that has a lot of kind of in the moment conscious cognitive abilities. And that creates a friction. And that is the human condition, right? Because on the one hand, we have urges and drives and these feelings. And on the other side, we have expectations put on us by our own self, our own moral compass, and also the society around us that we should and shouldn't do certain stuff. Mm. So it's no surprising that people don't get that right sometimes. And in fact, we all let ourselves down on a daily basis. We're not all murdering people and that kind of thing, I know. But we all have those moments where this stuff happens. And I think learning about the emotional experience, thinking more about it, makes us, this is what I've found with my colleagues in rescue when I've given talks at the rescue, and I've gone into this in more detail, obviously with my nice like slideshow and talking about neurology and physiology in a kind of a quite accessible way. They're not my specialities. I just know enough to kind of, so we can talk about it. Then they're thinking, well, actually my bucket gets a bit full. Actually, when I get to that point in the day, I'm not processing. Actually, I need to decompress. Actually, I need to find relief. Actually, I need to find that kind of balance. And it's important, and we can start looking in those terms, you know?
That makes a lot of sense. And on the note of rescues, I just want to spend a few minutes talking about the specific needs of rescue dogs, because I don't know what the official numbers are, but I'm seeing more and more people in my network and their networks who are now adopting rescues. You know, in the UK, there's a lot of rescue dogs being imported from other countries, somewhere between 7% and 20%. I think it's probably more than that of adopted dogs are returned to the shelters. And that doesn't account for dogs that are lost, died, given away, thrown in the streets, you know, God knows what else. So on a really practical level, someone thinking about adopting a rescue dog, where in some ways you kind of don't know what you're getting, what advice would you give them in order for them as individuals to be prepared to give the dogs the support they need? And then it would be great as well to talk about, you know, once they've brought that dog home, how do you support the dog in those early stages where it's still trying to adapt and settle?
I think the biggest victims of unrealistic expectation is a rescue dog, because it comes down to that, right? This notion that somehow dogs should be obedient, that we have these expectations about what behavior looks like, that somehow the dog should do as they're told, somehow that there are that somehow behavior for an animal is on some continuum of good to bad, which is ridiculous when you think about it. They can only be, you know what I mean? They can only express through their behavior. So interesting pet remedy that I work with, we've just got a new rescue partnership for rescues. And that includes a video that we put together, and I'm really proud of it. It's looking, so the idea is that, that people, before they adopt the dog, would watch the pre-adoption video. It's done in a bespoke way for each rescue, so the rescue would have their logo at the beginning and the end. But it actually takes people on a journey through the emotional needs of the dog and the important things to do that. And you're absolutely right. So the last lot of statistics I saw, it's 20%. So one in five dogs will be returned to the rescue within the first 6 months. Which is, and then why? Because sometimes it's because the it's not the right environment, but quite often it's because of the unrealistic expectations of the carer. They can be spoken to from the rescue, but they guess what? They're really excited about taking Rover home, so they're not really listening. They get given an adoption pack, which guess what? They never read. And then on day one, they're taking the dog down the beach. They've got all the family members to come and see the dog. They're trying to pet the dog. You know, there's a great YouTube video done by somebody. I can't remember what it was called, but it shows you from the dog's perspective and the human. So from the human, they're like, hey, come in here. There's your bed. Here's a treat. Do you want a stroke? From the dog's point of view, they're like, why do I want to sleep over there? Why do I want to sleep over there? Why are you giving me food? Why are you trying to touch me? All these kind of things, right? So this is understanding the emotional experience for me. And this is why my colleagues in rescue love this stuff. Because they get done a lot of training stuff and they're expected to click a train and do all the training. That's all wonderful. But actually passing some of those tools on to the client can feed in to the doctor, can feed back into those unrealistic expectations. Forget about training. Less is more. Take it slow and the trust will grow. That's Sarah Fisher, right? Great expression. So the best advice we can give to people with a rescue dog is get your expectations, think about what they are, and then put them to one side. Don't have visitors around to the house in that first few days, maybe in the first week. Give the dog a chance to get to know you first. Give your chance to get to know your dog. What do they like? What don't they like? What do they find a bit scary? What, you know, just learn from your dog, give them a chance to decompress, see where they might want to settle, be flexible with sleeping arrangements. Don't put too much pressure on. The first day, if possible, don't even take them out for a walk. Maybe the first couple of days, let them explore the garden if they've got one. Let them just decompress. When you start to go out into the environment, remember, everything is about those three things. It's kind of like the Holy Trinity, really. Sensory input, processing, nervous system. That process, that wonderful process, has to be working and fluid enough that we can just have elevation, decompression, elevation, decompression. Invariably, when these dogs come, they're just in elevation, 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 elevation. They're just not decompressing enough. And it can take a lot. These dogs invariably will have gone through forms of trauma. Even through a good, well-supported rescue system, they are still going to be. The more you learn about this stuff, you know, 1 minute the dog's at home, the next thing it's in a kennel. And then, you know, when's the owners coming back? You know, what's happening? I'm going to stay here, what's going to happen? And they're having to create, they're having to process this new environment, they have to process the new social connections with the teams in that rescue. Then they come to another place. And even on the day of pickup, that dog's had to process the car, the journey, the new home, so much stuff. So this is the thing we've got to really start thinking about and educating people about. It's no point handing over loads of training-y stuff, in my opinion. We need to, and that's why I'm so proud of this video, pre-adoption video, because the idea is before the person takes the dog, they're asked in the rescue or virtually to watch the pre-adoption video. And then so that it's there and people will take it on a bit more. But that's the thing for rescue dogs, we need to give them time. We need to take away the expectations. We need to be honest and truthful. I think about their needs, and there has to be a big shift societally, I think, about how we view dogs generally. I've got a foster puppy here at the moment, and just going out and about, it's amazing how many people just come up and just want to touch her. The ones who ask, I say no, because I don't want them to, because she's told me, because I've asked her through observation, that she likes to sniff. She likes to sniff people, and she's not that fussed. Guess what? If somebody comes over and they just go straight into her, she's going to go all wriggly bummed and be silly and jump up, because that doesn't mean she loves it. It means that she's giving a fun appeasement response. When she has the chance, she'd sooner sniff and go. So I want to do that. But all these people just come up and just start touching her. And I think we've got to start educating right from kids, really. Consent is a big word now, especially for, you know, bringing up young boys. You know, the notion of consent is really important. We should start with consent with animals. Why not? You know, why do we have it that we tell kids, oh, you must ask your parents to ask if it's okay? Maybe we should just tell kids, if you don't know the dog, if the dog isn't known to you, we don't touch them because we can't get consent from the dog. So yeah, bigger picture thing. So there you go. Rescue dogs, rescue cat, anything really. They need time. They need time. And then the carer needs to allow that dog to share their truth with them. And then they need to make adaptations for that dog. I call it alignment. It's finding alignment between the carer's needs, because they'll have them, and the dog's needs. And there is a middle ground to be found there. So while some rovers might not manage the beach, it's too much for them, they might manage the park. So we'll go to the park. The carer might be thinking, oh, well, I really want to go to the beach. Well, I don't fly very well. I'm not a very big flyer. My husband's a big Dolly Parton fan. He wants to go to Dollywood. We've been married for 7 years now, and we still haven't got there yet because I'm not quite ready yet. So he loves me enough to think, oh, wait till you're ready. So that when people say to me, yeah, but I want to sit outside the cafe with my dog, I share that story and I say, well, your dog's not ready yet. Doesn't mean they never will be, and you can have it as a goal and aspiration, but you have to build that right up gradually. And I invite people to look at their dog as a whole. So, you know, how often would you go to the cafe? Even if you went once a day, that's an hour a day out of 24 hours, where there's 23 hours of other great stuff you can be doing, right? So expectations, managing those is everything. And if people think about the emotional experience, I find they're more likely to shift those expectations. If you give them training goals, they're now going to think, right, if I do this, there must be a result. And then if there is no result, they then think, well, the dog's no good, or I'm no good, rather than thinking maybe the training's no good.
That's really interesting. I completely can relate to everything you said, because I had expectations when I adopted my dog Rosa, and very quickly when I brought her home, realized they had to go out the window. She's not the type of dog who will sit next to you on the sofa. She will come to you when she wants some affection, and it's in a very particular way, and that's it. And it's interesting when I've gone through the process of just really listening to her and reflecting on my own emotional needs and finding that middle ground with her, because I find great joy in being outdoors in nature and hiking and running and so forth. And so does she. And it's just that process of listening and giving her space and letting her come to me and tell me what she needs and when has been incredibly enlightening. And I think if I hadn't let go of my expectations, we would probably be in a very different place at the moment. So completely relate to what you said there, Andrew. And I think that's great advice for anyone thinking about adopting a rescue dog. And this pre-adoption video that's been done with Pet Rescue, that will be given to
Pet Remedy,
sorry, yeah. Will be given to shelters to provide to adopters.
So anybody who wants to become a Pet Remedy rescue partner, then it's a great scheme, actually, if I'm happy to share with you. But I set up a rescue panel of colleagues in the rescue community to work out what are the main things. One is revenue, of course, and secondly is about trying to improve adoption success. So we've got an amazing thing for the product. So nobody has to put any money up front for the product. Everything is done sale and return. Big chance of revenue stuff there. And the huge discount even on wholesale cost, so it's a winner from a financial point of view. And then they get the rescue video, which is done by a proper TV company. It's very professionally done. It's beautifully done, actually, and lots of other extras and that kind of thing. So if anybody's interested in that, they can contact info@petremedy.co.uk.
Okay.
And they can just say, I'm interested in learning more about the rescue partnership. But yeah, so that's an important thing, I think. when the big thing I hear about a lot, obviously I've talked about a bit today, is I kind of get this stuff, Andy, but what does it mean? How does it work? And I think that's where we just need more education about it. The operant stuff, the training stuff, is important. Of course it is. Mm-hmm. But up until relatively recently, that's been the only show on the road, right? And your friend, and maybe even your own dog, but definitely the person you're talking about earlier, realized that actually for some of these dogs, all the training in the world, she said she had multiple trainers, multiple behaviorists, who I'm sure were brilliant. But if they're only looking at changing behavior and not thinking about the emotional experience that lies beneath it. And there's a big difference, by the way, between recognizing a dog's emotional state and trying to understand their emotional experience. The two are different. You know, recognizing the dog's stress now, that's recognizing the dog's emotional state. Understanding the dog's emotional experience, how they connect with the world around them, what their truth is different. And that means being available to do good observations and slow stuff down. And that can be difficult when people come see me, for example, because they're like, well, hang on, my dog's got dog issues and we haven't seen a dog yet. And I'm like, well, no, we've got to learn more from your dog first before we can do that and try and introduce things gradually for them. Yeah. I think it's important. The I finished. I was going to say something else, but that's gone.
No, that's fine. No, I think I love what you said about slowing down. I was talking to someone earlier interviewing Max Easy, founder of Horse Charming, and we were saying how important it is to slow down to speed up later. And if you try speed up too early, then you slow down later on, or you don't really make any progress. And I love the differentiation you make between emotional experience and emotional state. And are you saying with that then a state is, it's almost time bound in a way? So you go through different emotional states depending on environment, context, and how you respond to that versus an emotional experience, which is your ongoing perception and relationship with the world and environment around you.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, we've all have been there, and we've all been in a certain emotional state, and people have tried to, you know, with good intentions to support us or get us, but they're focusing on where we're at. But actually, we know it's bigger than that. It's more than that. And this is the thing, you know, we talked about expectations earlier. That's why I wrote that piece, Whose Behavior Is It Anyway? Arthur, who's my sensitive dog, he does annoy me. There's no choice about it. I kind of, you know, it pisses me off. But I'm aware of my emotional experience and I don't beat myself up for that. I recognize that, yeah, sometimes my bucket gets a bit full as well. And that's why I keep using this word alignment. I have to think about his care needs. I also have to think about mine sometimes. Sometimes I can't do what he needs for him to completely decompress. I know he's loved, I know he's safe, and I'll have to deal with that because sometimes I've got to do what I've got to do. And that's okay as well. This is the point, it's okay. It's just being truthful about what we're doing, I think, and just recognizing it for what it is. And that's what it's all about, really. And anybody who listens to any education I do, or even listening in now, what I love about this approach is, we were talking about this earlier, but it's accessible to anybody. You don't need a skill set to be empathetic, compassionate. I've got my cake analogy, compassion, awareness, knowledge, empathy, because we all like cake, right? So always bring cake if you can. Compassion, awareness, knowledge, empathy. We can all be that if we allow ourselves to be available. We don't need to know all the jargon. We don't need to know neurology and physiology. We just need to know that maybe our dog needs something different sometimes. And the other thing as well is that all I really ask for anybody is to listen to these kind of things and think, what does that mean for me and my truth? It doesn't mean that if you're a trainer, you think, oh my God, I've got to change everything I do. No, it's a case of, oh, whether you're a groomer or whether you're a vet or whether you're a caregiver, what does this mean for me? How can I be better at being available to the truth of others? Not just a dog, but your neighbor, your partner, your workmate. But most importantly, how can I be more aware of my own truth? Because it gets muddied very quickly in this very high speed environment where everything has to happen yesterday. Sometimes just getting in the moment and thinking, right, I'm just going to experience what I'm experiencing now, even if that's uncomfortable, even if that's not nice. It's my experience.
Andrew, that was deep.
Deep one up. There you go.
I know I've learned so much speaking to you today. And like I said before, when I first reached out to you to ask you to join me on the podcast, I've been a huge fan of your work and everything you're saying around shifting the narrative and the importance of us taking a step back as dog owners, as industry, as trainers, and really just try and think about this from a different angle. I feel like there's lots of food for thought in this episode, and I certainly will be doing a lot of reflection about my own emotions and my dog's emotional experience as well. So thank you so much for joining me today on Rescue Tales, Andrew.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. And anybody who's listening from the rescue community who want to come along to the Dog Centre Care Group on Facebook, you want to contact me about doing stuff for the rescues, I'm always happy to support rescues. And anybody who wants to know more about these things or wants to arrange anything to be done for the future, then just get in touch. But I really appreciate that your own passion and vision with this, actually. I think it's really important.
Thank you, Andrew. I'll link to your website and social handles so listeners will know where to find you.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Andrew.